This is an ABC podcast.
That's the hoot of a powerful owl. Powerful owls are the largest owls in Australia. They're about 60 centimetres high, with bright yellow eyes and big yellow feet. And because they can't move their eyes around, they bob their heads like fluffy breakdancers. Powerful owls are found from southeastern Queensland all around to South Australia. But the owls that my guest today knows best live in Wombat Forest in regional Victoria, which is also home to Tanya Lewes, field naturalist and nature writer. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Sarah.
When you hear that owl sound, what do you think? What comes to mind?
Oh, I'm just immediately thrilled, and I get this sense of home, I guess.
You live, Tanya, in Wombat Forest. How would I get to your place? Where is it?
Well, Wombat Forest, it's kind of in between Ballarat, Bendigo and Woodend. So you would, if you're leaving from Melbourne, you'd travel up either of the highways, and it's kind of 60,000 hectares of forest straddled between the Calder and the freeway going to Ballarat.
And what kind of trees are there in that forest?
Beautiful trees. I love them all. Look, it's a mixed species foothill forest is what it's known as. So foothill forests are the forests that are kind of hugging the bottom of the Great Dividing Range. They're not the mountain ash. They're not alpine forests. And so the variety of the trees depends on where you are in the forest. Where I am here, it's very mixed species. It's largely messmate, but there's also a lot of scent bark, narrowleaf peppermint, candlebark, and it's just beautiful. And but then as you travel a little bit higher altitude and where it's wetter, you get different species such as Brooker's gums, and the form of the messmates changes. Instead of branching early in a more kind of woodland style, they get really tall and amazing.
Do you live amid those trees? What's your actual house like?
I live right in them. I'm like looking at all sorts of trees now, and nestled, I think is the word, yes.
And what birds are closest to your place then? What can you hear and see from your yard?
Oh, wow. Well, my best friends here are the white-winged choughs. So for people who don't know what choughs are, they're just wonderful, and they're black and white birds that cruise along the ground in very noisy groups. And I've got an aviary of rescue birds, and when I go and put the old food out on the compost, they all perch next to me and call, and they bulge their eyeballs. They've got these red eyeballs with pink skin, and they bulge their eyes out as an excitement display. I know, it's really funny. We've also got gangang cockatoos, all sorts of honey eaters, and because we're on the edge of the central Victorian uplands, because we've got the goldfields bioregion, you know, it goes down onto the plain, I actually get occasional woodland birds visiting me and occasional wet forest birds visiting me, like crescent honey eaters. So there's a bit of a straddle. And of course, we get owls.
Well, what about wombats, though? The place is called Wombat Forest.
Yeah, I giggled then because it's such a misnomer. It should be called Wallaby Forest because there's swamp wallabies everywhere. I've been leading walks and walking around the Wombat for 19 years, and I was doing a lot of kid education, and I saw my first live wombat, I think 5 years ago, and yeah, it was amazing. And it was with a group, and one of the parents thought I'd put a wombat statue on the other side of the creek to entertain the kids because they're very shy. You don't see them during the day. And but it was just that the wombat was frozen, very still, looking at us.
So it took that long, though, before you spotted a wombat in Wombat Forest.
Yeah.
What do the wallabies make of you if there are lots of those?
Look, wallabies are a lot like most animals. It really depends on what you are like and what your life is like. So when I had a terrier here, the wallabies would run away. And when I had a very elderly, friendly dog here, they just are oblivious. And when it's just me, they don't mind either. They might stop chewing as you walk past.
Yeah, why do they do that? I've noticed that wallabies do that. What's that about?
I don't know. It's almost like a, you can't see me if I'm not chewing. That's what I think it is. Yeah, I don't know.
Just going to freeze and you're going to keep walking.
Yeah,
and,
that's
and
right.
We're all good.
Yeah.
So you've lived there nearly for 2 decades. You moved around a lot as a kid. What's it like being rooted in one place the way you have been there?
Oh, it's just wonderful. I can't describe it. It's really good for the soul. It's something I didn't know that I needed. I never hankered. I never was upset about moving. I was always up for something new. But yeah, I've just fallen in love, and I love being able to look at the same tiny little shrub and know what is happening with that shrub year by year, you know?
So there mightn't be too many wombats, but there are powerful owls in this forest. Do you remember the first time you spotted one?
I remember the first time I really heard one, because I knew that they were around because I was in the wombat forest group at the time, and, you know, owls were of conservation concern. So we're always talking about them, and I'd heard them before I saw them. And it was actually in the very, very tall messmate, the eucalyptus above our house. And we were watching a DVD and we heard this completely thrilling call. So we went outside and just listened to it. Now, they can call for quite a long time, and they also are very loud. The call extends for up to 2 kilometres. So we listened to that for a while and then just went back inside and finished the movie.
I don't know if that makes you a good field naturalist or not. So are you more likely to hear an owl before you spot it?
Yes, I think so, yeah. From about 2003 to 2006, field naturalist me, which I was very impressed when I found my notes, I'd actually recorded all the times I'd heard and seen owls over a 3-year period. And there's many more heard records than seen.
And are you more likely to hear or even see them at night than during the day?
With owls, there's 2 ways really to come across owls, okay? So the first way is the way that I was just talking about then, when you hear it and then you go outside and have a look. But the other way is basically during the day, and then that's when someone, an owl enthusiast, shows you where they've seen them, because you can see them roosting during the day.
Is it that thing, though, when you're looking out looking for a bird in particular, it's probably easy to mistake everything that you see. Is that must be it? Is that it? Like, is it hard to kind of train your eye to find the thing you're really after?
Oh, no, no, because they're so big. Like, you think of a ruler. So 2 rulers in height. So when you're looking at a tree, if you just imagine the canopy of a tree, a dark mass that's that big, even just the silhouette of it is quite obvious. It does take a bit of looking because you've got to be at the right angle sometimes. I was surveying for some birds for an environment group here, and this was actually near Newstead, and I was like, oh my God, is that a koala? It was that big. I thought it was a koala, but it was actually a powerful owl.
Tell me about the pair that you found breeding near your place.
Oh, yeah. Look, this is the most thrilling thing. I know I keep saying thrilling, but that is the absolute best word to describe.
What was
a
that
powerful
bird that
owl.
Eyes were exploding in excitement? I feel that that's what you're doing. You like that little chuff, was it?
Yes, exactly. Where I am, there's thick forest and then there's sheep country on kind of patchy either side, and there's this roadside about 3 or 4 kilometres walk from me, and it has very large manor gums with hollows. And the day that I saw a powerful owl chick, which meant that they were breeding there, I was so excited. I ran all the way home, and I'm not really a fitness person, but I was just so pumped because and I was talking to my friend Gail Osborne, who's in Wombat Forest Care and an absolute owl enthusiast. And we were just talking about how when you see a powerful owl in the wild and they're looking at you, you just get the biggest high, because they're such a huge sort of fierce, wild animal. And yet when you're looking at each other, it's like you're sharing the same world. And it's just such an amazing feeling.
What was happening with that breeding pair? How many babies were nesting?
Yeah, so they bred there twice. So the first time I only saw one baby, and then the next time they were breeding there, I actually found a dead chick and was pretty concerned about it. So I contacted someone locally, a scientist, Todd Soderquist, who was studying powerful owls in the Box Ironbark region, which is like the forests sort of next to Wombat Forest. And he said, look, often there's two owls, two chicks known as owlets, which is very cute, two owlets. And so he encouraged me to go back that night and listen and watch to see if there was another owlet that emerged, and happily there was.
Well, I think, as you say, about what's striking about the size and the sort of wildness of those birds, you know, I think even the most nature ignorant or cynical among us, you couldn't walk past an owl. Like, if you saw it or heard it, there's something so compelling about them that feels different than a lot of other animals.
Yeah, I think it's the forward-facing eyes. They're very penetrating. They just stare at you. And, you know, birds are dinosaurs. They literally are dinosaurs. And so it's this, some birds manage to retain that kind of otherworldly, mysterious vibe. And I think powerful owls do that very well.
Is there any way of telling if you're seeing the same ones? You know, if you spot birds at different places or different times, are they different from one another if you just catch them in the wild?
Yeah, I don't think so. So there are some great studies looking at how to recognize individual animals, like, for example, koala noses have different patterns on them, and I believe they haven't been able to do that with owls, and that's why there's a lot of questions remaining about how they select a mate and their survivorship and some of their interactions with each other, like socially. It's tricky to tell.
Do they travel over a wide range, Tanya, or do they kind of stay close to their home?
It depends on the food available. So in an area that is rich with food, which their favourite is actually mammals, things like greater gliders and possums and ringtail possums, then they'll have a smaller home range and they can hunt within that, and that will sustain the family. In areas like the Box Ironbark and that study I was talking about before, the radio tracking showed that they needed, this poor powerful owl pair needed to range up to 5,000 hectares to get enough food for its chick. And obviously that's not ideal because you're expending a lot of energy. But here in the Wombat, there's at least six pairs. So if you think of six pairs dotted over 60,000 hectares, they cover a bit of ground.
Without being too gruesome, how does a powerful owl eat a possum? How does it go about devouring a mammal?
Oh, I don't mind a bit of gruesome. They grab them with their talons and they quickly dispatch them by a bite to the back of the skull. So it's a quick end for the animal, and then they'll either eat them then and there.
Sort of head to toe or in parts?
Well, I think it would depend on the size of the prey. So I imagine that there'd be different prey handling techniques, whether they're talking about a glider, or they do eat birds, parrots as well. I imagine the smaller it is, it would just be gobbled up in a gulp, just down the hatch. I did read that, you know, even though these birds are quite fierce and awe-inspiring, they're pretty romantic as well. And the male will eat the head and then offer the rest of the body to the female as a love gift, as a keeping the courtship going.
You say they eat parrots. Do they catch them as they're flying? How do they get a parrot?
Yeah, look, they use the same technique that they use to hunt other animals. They basically just snatch them out of the trees. So it would be a sleeping cockatoo or a sleeping galah. So, yeah, that's what would happen.
That is a really bad wake-up call for that bird.
Exactly. Can you imagine them making... Can you imagine, like, the cockatoos just... Yeah, because they have intensely social lives, and so then to wake up and Gary's gone, you know, they'd be really upset.
So do they build nests, Tanya, or where are they living in an ideal habitat?
Yeah, look, they definitely... they need hollows. So like so much Australian fauna, they need tree hollows to breed in, and because the owls are so big, they need big tree hollows.
And what do they do inside that? Do they furnish it with leaves or sticks, or is it just literally the hollow of the tree that they dwell inside?
Yeah, some birds line it with gum leaves, and they reckon it has a really nice antimicrobial quality, but I don't think powerful owls do. And so it's basically just the hollow. They might scratch out and make sure there's some soft wood chips down at the bottom, but otherwise it's the right hollow will create a habitat for the right sort of nesting habitat for the owlets.
And does it need to be a big tree then, as you say, or an old tree? What were they quite selective about the sort of hollow that will work?
Oh, definitely. So 300 years is the age of the tree is what's bandied around. And look, like many forests in Australia, particularly foothill forests, we don't actually have any old growth here. The only hollow-bearing trees, as they're known, that are left are ones that have actually individually had old timber cutters go, that one's too twisted, or it's near the road, or it's quite a nice one. We'll leave that one and we'll take the rest. This is in the days of selective harvesting. And I think there's hollow-bearing trees of that size on private land. So we're actually really surprised at the number of owls that are managing to breed in the Wombat Forest, because there's also competition for hollows with birds such as sulfur-crested cockatoos.
But you'd think in a fight between a cockatoo and a powerful owl, it's the powerful owl that I'd be putting my money on.
I don't know. I would actually think that the cockatoo would win, because they're so intelligent and they're so brash and they're so bold. They're also sort of devilishly inventive. I could imagine them coming up with ways to torture the powerful owl that the powerful owl just wouldn't know what was going on and just be really befuddled.
Given their size, Tanya, how do they not bang into things as they fly through the forest? What helps them steer?
Birds are incredible. They process images in a way that's much, much faster than humans. And so their calculations of depth and perception, and how they're probably their proprioception abilities at the tips of their fingers, are so much more attuned than we could even imagine. And they just whip through using a combination of those different senses. And that's why they would have preferred the forests as they originally were, which is basically giant, massive eucalypts and giant, massive blackwoods, which are a very important tree to them. That's a type of wattle, and then other trees, but much more spacious. We're in a regrowth forest here, so it's quite sort of bitsy with lots of smaller stems.
How do powerful owls choose a mate? How does that part of the life cycle get going?
Well, we don't know what influences mate choice, because of what I was talking about before with not being able to mark individuals, and other researchers might know more than me on this, but I know that the courting period is long, protracted, very romantic, and it's...
Tell me more. Tell me about this long, protracted, romantic courtship period for the powerful owl.
Oh, it's just lovely. And this is the wonderful thing about how owls have that corollary of being fierce and gruesome, but also lovely. So in the early stages, they roost together, not always in the same tree, but they are in calling distance. and they'll do duets. Well, the hoot hoot, and then the hoot hoot, and the from the other one. Then just before they start nesting, they roost side by side. And then this is the other thing that they do a lot. It's known as allopreening. It's they preen each other, and so they nibble the facial feathers like what parrots do. So they're very affectionate, and so they preen each other. They have a special call which is known as a bleat, which is like a sheep baaing, which I was lucky enough to hear when I went and was down at that breeding pair that I was talking about before. And it's just the funniest thing to hear this sheep-like call coming from an owl. Also, the male presents food to the female. So he's showing her that he is a good partner, that when she is sitting on the eggs, that he'll be able to provide for her. Yeah, it's quite lovely.
And the mating process itself, is that studied? Is that known? Is it long? What happens when that happens?
When they're actually copulating.
Exactly. The questions that other people are afraid to ask, Tanya, what is happening when the powerful owls are copulating?
Well, most of the studies that are written up that I've read talk about what they do in captivity, but there's definitely preening involved there. Like a lot of birds, it doesn't go on for that long, and it can be repeated a few times as well.
Do they stay in their pairs?
Yes, they do. And David Flier, that fantastic, great naturalist, he recorded that they maintain the pair bond for 30 years or more in one pair.
And that's extraordinary. That's such a long time. So does that sort of the behaviours that are seen there during courtship and as a precursor to mating, do they continue even outside of the breeding cycle?
Yeah. They're really quite affectionate. And they really need a mate. There's records of when one partner died, the male called for a full 7 years without finding another mate. So their urge to breed and to be with another is very strong.
That's a very heartbreaking prospect, the 7 year unanswered call.
I know.
How do they divide up the workload once the little owlets come along?
I think it's the female generally will be the, like, so the male brings the food, and then the female, depending on the size of the owlet, like when they're tiny little bits of fluff, she tears off the tiniest fragments of possum or glider or koala and gives it, or flying fox or rat. You know, they have quite varied diets. They tiny bit of meat to the tiny little owlets, and then as they get bigger, those pieces get larger. And then when the bird, when the owlet fledges, which means it's ready to leave the nest, it actually will be with the parents for quite some time, getting to know the territory, learning how to hunt.
Do the owlets and the parents have a way of calling to one another that's different from the parents calling to one another or ours as adults? Like, is there a child-adult kind of language that you can hear?
The most common call for the juvenile is called a trilling. And so the owlets will trill, and they'll either trill to each other, or they trill to their parents, or they trill as a begging call. And it's so incongruous to see a 60 centimetre high baby owl looking fierce as anything, going tee-hoo, tee-hoo, tee-hoo.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. Find out more. Just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Tanya, owls are more than just nature, aren't they? Because they've got such a strong symbolic role, such a strong place in various cultures. I mean, they're associated with wisdom, or sometimes it's with more sinister concepts. Are you aware of that wider human use of owls and the symbolism of owls when you're out there with the real ones in the wild?
I have to admit, I know that there's so many different ways to view all of the animals that I share this forest with, and I'm such a science buff, and so the myths to me aren't as important as the thrill of understanding what it's like for them as owls, if you know what I mean, rather than the story that I could hear as a human that talks about the owls. I want to live in and understand and experience how the owls live and what their story is.
So you're not someone who lives surrounded by, you know, owlabilia and bird tea towels and magnets and the rest.
Oh my God, I have bird everything. Yes, I'm just looking in, I'm in my study now and I've got this like owls and feathers and pigeons and all sorts of things. And so, but again, that's the idolizing of them as themselves, if you know what I mean, rather than them as we see them as humans. So it's an awkward way to say it, but it's not so much the myth as me being in absolute love and idolizing the animals themselves and the lives they lead.
Do you ever dream about owls?
Yes, sometimes. I had the most wonderful dream once, and I do dream about lots of different nature things, which I find so gratifying and also very, yeah, just keeps me going. And so this particular dream, it was a very fierce looking powerful owl, and she was basically saying to me, she was staring at me in that really full-on way where you don't know whether your head's going to be ripped off or you're going to be eaten or whatever, but she was looking at me and she said, "Good on you, Tanya. Keep doing what you're doing. Keep advocating for the forest. Keep writing about nature." And I just was so happy when I woke up. I couldn't believe it.
When you mentioned feathers, what's special about an owl's feathers?
Yes, so owl feathers are the most wonderful creations. I have a collection here. I get lots of calls and people sending me photos, "Can you identify this feather?" And often it's a tawny frogmouth feather, or sometimes it might be a powerful owl feather. They're both brown, they're both kind of large, but the difference between the tawny frogmouth, which isn't an owl, and the owl is that the actual structure of the feather is very different. And so all owls have this unique adaptation whereby the feathers are fringed. So they're known as flutings, apparently. So you get these fringed trailing edges of the feather, but also on the plane of the feather, so the flat surface of the feather, there's this velvety kind of fluff. And what this does is actually... What it does is
squeaking?
It actually makes
What's
the...
What's that squeeking that I can hear?
I'm so sorry. Guinea pigs. I forgot about them. I've got... Because my friend is in hospital, and so I've just been looking after these two male guinea pigs who've been so quiet all day until now.
I'm so happy. I assumed it was some kind of bird life, but for the guinea pig's sake, I'm very glad there's no powerful owl in the vicinity.
Yes, exactly.
Because they would squeak no more.
Oh, no. I'm so sorry. So basically what we've got is if we've got fringe-like leading edge of the wings and also this velvety surface on the flat plane of the feather, and they mask the sound. And so that means that owls, when they're coming up to their prey, are ready to either snatch them from the tree or get them off the ground, depending on what kind of owls they are, they're silent. And this is absolutely to the most fullest extent in the barn owl. So there's two kinds of owls in Australia. There's like eagle owls, which is what the powerful owl is a part of. And then there's the Taito family, which is like the barn owls or the mast owls. And they have those facial discs, the heart-shaped feather area around the face, but they've also got these fringed feathers that allow for completely silent flight, and it's just an incredible adaptation.
Some kids seem just to be orientated towards nature right from the get-go. Were you like that?
Oh, completely. So there's photos of me in Canada with chipmunks and looking at deer and looking at orangutans at the zoo. But I think a lot of little kids are really into nature. But when I was about five, when we were in England, my mum's best friend gave me a little book on, I think it was English pond life. And from then on, I was completely hooked.
What would it have been about English pond life that grabbed your imagination at four or five?
I guess it was just the variety of life. I don't know, but it's always been with me. And when I look back at old drawings and I've kept journals, I've always been writing about nature and noticing it.
David Attenborough has been a kind of spiritual godfather to, I think, generations of kids like you. Was he like that for you too?
Oh, 100%. So we were in England in, I think, 1980, and I believe that's when the Life on Earth series was really popular. And I don't actually remember watching the show, but I bought the book Life on Earth and also Discovering Life on Earth, or my parents bought it for me, from around probably 9 or 10. And even though I couldn't understand all of it, I just read it avidly and looked at the pictures, and it just was completely inspired.
And have you ever seen him do a talk or give a talk, Tanya?
I have, Sarah. It was 4 or 5 years ago, and he gave a wonderful talk, and yeah, it was just amazing when he walked out. Everyone just stood up, and it was the first time in my life. Like, usually I get thrilled by things like Powerful Owls, but the thrill to see Sir David walking into the room and everyone just kind of losing it because they were so happy to see this guy who'd brought so much joy and understanding to so many people. Yeah, it was just wonderful.
Were you brave enough to go and talk about the influence he'd been on you?
No, look, it's one of life's regrets. I'm always like, you know, famous people, everyone wants a piece of them, and they have to contend with so much of other people's energy wanting to talk to them. And I thought, gosh, you know, this guy, he's, well, back then I thought he was getting elderly, but he's still going strong. And I thought, oh, I won't bother him. And I actually mentioned to his producer, oh, look, you know, he's got a huge line, he probably wants to go back to his hotel room. And she even gave me a business card and said, look, write to him. And I handed on personally, and I just got starstruck, and I actually never followed it up, but I it's on my to-do list.
There's
nearly
still time.
Every day.
There's still time.
There's still time, yes.
You mentioned England and you mentioned Canada. Why were you moving around so much as a kid?
Yeah, so my dad was a geologist, and he worked for various mining and exploration companies, and so mainly with BP. So, yeah, that was the reason.
And which of those places that you lived in felt most like home to you?
Ah, see, when you're a kid, whatever is normal to you is kind of normal. And so what was normal to me is that every time I'd hear from dad or mum and dad that we were moving, I would just get out my nature books and immediately start studying whatever animals lived there. And so I always felt really at home wherever I was. And expat kids are a bit like that. Like at the, for example, the Karachi International School, there was only like two or three kids from each nationality. And so your friendships that you form, the connection you have with place and nature, well, nature for me, it's very much in the now, because you don't know you're going to be moving again.
What early memories do you have of of looking at birds in particular?
Yeah, look, we had a holiday house in Caloundra, Queensland, and we'd have this 3-month American schooling holiday in the winter of Caloundra, and because birds were the most accessible, I suppose, for looking around during the day, and also insects and to a lesser extent fish, but mainly birds. What I would do is I would just, Mum said that I would, you know, grab my binoculars, because I've had binoculars since I was 8, binoculars, notebook, sandwich, and just wobble away on my bike, and I'd go and explore all of the mangroves and the paperbark swamps, and I'd be looking at, in those swamps, I'd be looking at ospreys, all the different water birds that visit the mangroves, and also the seabirds and waders along the beach, eastern curlews, Australasian gannets, and I've still got my diaries today, which is really lovely because I can see when I've made drawings and excited notes about the first time I've seen a bird.
That Sunshine Coast landscape, it would have been changing a lot at that period too. I'm guessing that's when there were new estates going up, when there were roads being built.
Yeah, look, it's pretty sad. I haven't been back much. You know, we're really a Victorian family these days, so I don't spend much time in Queensland. But I think about 8 years ago, I had a look on Google Earth, and all of the old bird watching haunts are now housing. And I got to experience that firsthand. My favourite river mouth, which was a mangrove estuary, was one of my favourite bird watching spots. And I used to sit in this beautiful wattle and write in my little notebook and just get that sense of peace. Of you get the sucking sounds of the crabs and things and birds calling, but just a very gentle kind of sound. I'd just be there for hours noting down the bird life, and one day I rode in there on my bike and the entire thing had been bulldozed, both sides. The wattle tree was still standing. And so I just climbed up into the tree and just sort of cried and reflected on how the need for something as simple as a house and a place to live in could end up being just so damaging for other species.
Did you always plan then on working in nature as you grew older?
Yes, I did. I was looking through my old little nature journal the other day, and I'd written down all these different scientific roles. And when I'd written ecologist, that's the one I'd circled. This is when I was 11. However, I love words. I love writing. I love natural history. And I'm not so good at maths. And so when it came to the university stage of things, I started off doing a double English and science degree, and I was really struggling. The recommendation at the time was to drop the science and continue with the arts, because I had a real, I guess, inclination towards English and expression. But after doing an English degree, nothing was going to stop me doing my nature stuff. And so I ended up just falling into the work. And so I'm one of those practitioners, so an ecology practitioner. So I've always worked in the nature sector.
What different flavour does it bring to the way you approach your scientific work, given that you didn't do the kind of formal training at university, which I guess might be a more standard route nowadays? What does it mean for the way you approach the natural world?
That's a really great question. I think the biggest difference is that the way it works with ecology, with science, is that you specialise. So you might become a native wasp taxonomist and you know everything there is to know about wasp genitalia because that's what you study in
now,
order to
that's the
to
person
do.
I need to interview. The wasp genitalia hour.
Exactly. It's pretty funny. So that's a real specialisation. And so as a field naturalist, as someone like, I did go back and do study in ornithology, a graduate certificate at Charles Sturt Uni when I was in my mid-30s, because I thought, I've got to get some more science skills, because I kept getting all these great jobs, but I felt a bit like imposter syndrome because I had an English degree. But the difference is that I'm a generalist, so I can talk to you about owl, I can do vegetation, I'm really into insects, mammals, and I think a lot of the best ecologists and scientists, if they have the time, then they do integrate the study of all different sorts of things to see how they fit together. But often you don't have the luxury of doing that if you are a scientist who is focused very much on a particular field, because there's just so much to learn about everything.
When did you find other people then who shared your obsessions with the natural world?
So all of my nature study that I did as a kid and a teenager was sort of by myself, in a way, just learning from books. And when I joined the Victorian Field Naturalists of Victoria in my 20s, they all just completely were like, oh my God, a young person, this is so exciting. And I was like, yep, happy to be here. And I joined the board and everything. And it's very much like the bird clubs, because I've been involved with BirdLife Australia for decades as well. And it's almost like CWA Association. You've got your minutes, you've got your meetings, you've got your tea afterwards with the biscuits. And, you know, it's very ordered and really quite lovely and sort of comforting in a way.
What about now? Do you like looking for powerful owls or other birds and animals by yourself or with other people?
It is equally good with someone or solo. So most birders, myself included, what they do is a lot of sort of private exaltation, if I could call it that, where you wander around the forest just listening, standing, because so much of bird watching is by ear. I can recognize all the calls of the local birds. And so you just get in the moment then, and time isn't really, you know, it's immaterial. But if you go out with friends, any of my wonderful birding friends, if you see something magical, you get to share it with them and exult together, if you know what I mean. And so, and then that way you can go back and go, oh, remember when we saw that superb lyrebird calling in the Dandenongs? That was the best. And you can reminisce about those times. So yeah, I'd say both are very important. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the citizen science project Hoot Detective that you've been involved with that's running at the moment.
Yeah, sure. It's a great project. So there's powerful owl projects all over Australia, and most of them, a lot of them are, when I say all over Australia, over the East Coast where powerful owls occur, and so many of them have to do with citizen scientists going out to monitor the actual owls. But Hoot Detective is very different. So the Australian Acoustic Observatory has set up sound recorders in reserves all over Australia, remote reserve. Some of them are quite remote, and they've got these recorders recording soundscapes continuously. And the Hoot Detective project allows citizen scientists from their computer to actually log on and listen to 10-second sound clips from these different areas. And then what you're doing is you're actually categorizing the sound. So below the spectrogram, you have like different owl calls and possum, koala, other birds, wind, rain. And when you listen to the clip, you click on what you can hear, and you're actually training the AI to be able to recognize and then produce data for the scientists so they can work out what's happening in these more remote areas.
What have you noticed about how prepared people are to give time to listen to just the sounds of these remote forests and help train that AI? What kind of hours are people logging?
It's amazing. It's very addictive. The developers have done such a good thing, because once you listen to one clip, the next one comes up. So you go, oh, I'll just do one more. And then you're like, oh, but maybe I'll hear a chick trilling in this one. Oh, I just did one. And so the last I heard, one person had logged 16 hours Hoot Detective work, which I want to meet this person because I'm so impressed, because it's the 10 second clip. Like, that is so many clips. So they have just taken to it. Like, wow. They're just loving it, obviously.
And then all of this information through AI is processed so that the software can itself work out what's the owl and distinguish it from other sounds.
Yeah, that's right. Because the field of bioacoustics is moving along a lot, because at the moment you need to have a human who can recognize calls to verify what is being recorded. And so if you can actually have AI doing it, then you can analyze what's called big data. So like terabytes and terabytes of data, and you can actually pull stuff out of it and go, wow, isn't this interesting? Powerful owls and barking owls are calling at different times, or they're not occurring in the same places, or they are, or this is, and because the chicks trill, it's very easy for scientists to be able to study whether owls are breeding, and also even breeding success, I imagine, because it's an amazing tool.
You call yourself, Tanya, an enthusiast rather than an expert. What's that suggest about your philosophy, I guess, when it comes to encountering owls and nature more generally?
I guess what I most feel when I am in the forest or looking at animals or learning something new or seeing a common animal do something cool that I'd never seen before, I just feel this sense of, I guess, joy and enthusiasm. And that comes from a deep love. And if I can share that joy and enthusiasm in such a way that people want to come along for the ride and also be switched on and feel that same joy and love that I feel, then that has two wonderful outcomes. One is that a human, it's pretty hard to be a human will end up feeling better about life, because you're getting this wonderful top-up of joy and connection and love from these magical moments in nature, whether you're by yourself or with friends. And then the other thing is that then you're more likely to care about animals and the environment, because you feel this love and connection. And ultimately, if you feel so much love and connection for the animals and plants around you, then it's almost like your well-being is tied up with the fate of nature around you.
Do you think that you have to live somewhere as beautiful as Wombat Forest to have that experience?
I don't think so, because when I was growing up, we were always in big, disgusting Southeast Asian cities. I don't mean disgusting in a horrible way. I just more mean polluted and sprawling and all of that. And, you know, where you wouldn't think of magical, perfect, pristine nature, it's not relevant, because all nature is good in a way. And urban nature is increasingly recognized as actually, it's a lot of endangered species in the cities like Melbourne that need our care. I have to say, though, living in the forest is such an intimate way to to get to know the animals who live here.
I think that's telling. I think it's clear where your community is. It's been a beautiful introduction today. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks, Sarah.
Tanya Luz was my guest on Conversations today. I'm Sarah Konoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Konoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Hey, I'm Benjamin Law.
And I'm Beverly Wang, and we're the co-hosts of the ABC podcast, Stop Everything.
Now, if you love a good chat, which is a very strong possibility since you've just finished Conversations,
come and join us over on Stop Everything, because every week, Ben and I talk through what's making news in the world of pop culture.
So if you've ever wanted to know the backstory of why a celebrity is apologising, what they're apologising for, and why it might not be quite landing, or the reasons why a particular meme is cropping up all over your social feed and how it's a sign of the times, then Stop Everything is for you.
Ben and I talk to each other, but we also talk to some of the most exciting creators, thinkers, and observers of screen, audio, and online culture. We get deep into how and why pop culture reflects and affects the world.
That's Stop Everything with me, Benjamin Law.
And me, Beverly Wang. Follow Stop Everything now on the ABC Listen app.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.